Eddie, did you know there's a pharmaceutical company right across the street from us?
You're going to have to be a little bit more specific, Tyler.
Oh, right. We're in Central Square. Yeah, so Novartis is actually right across the street from us, and we haven't really tapped them for a podcast interview yet, even though it would be great to have somebody because we haven't had anybody from industry. I went to Agene straight out of grad school, so I don't really have a lot of experience in industry. I have a few friends who have taken pharmaceutical industry jobs, but it's great that we're getting Crystal Shi's perspective in this podcast.
Great, then let's get to it.
Today we're talking to Crystal Shi. Crystal is an investigator 3 at Novartis, a multinational pharmaceutical company based in Switzerland. After completing her PhD in chemistry and chemical engineering with Harry Gray at Caltech, Crystal moved on to a postdoc in the chemistry department at MIT. Crystal now works on protein therapeutics at Novartis. One pro tip from Crystal: be agile and willing to move on to new projects when old ones prove unsuccessful. Listen to learn more about Crystal's exciting career path, to gain insight into industry research, and to get advice on how to succeed in your own career. So, to start off, Crystal, could you provide us with a little background on who you are and how you got into your position at Novartis?
Okay, sure. I'm Crystal Shi. I grew up in Michigan, and after going to college at MIT, where I majored in chemistry, I ended up deciding to go to grad school in chemistry. I went across the country to California, to Caltech, and basically 5 years later, I got my PhD, still in chemistry, and ended up back here for my postdoc at the labs of Joanne Stubbe over at MIT in the chemistry department. So you can see that my training is mainly chemistry. Mm-hmm. And then when I was applying for jobs, I first noticed something. I didn't know how pharma is organized. No one ever knows how pharma is organized from the outside, right? Yeah. And like, if you ask me today, how is Pfizer organized? I don't know enough about Pfizer, and the structures are always different. So all I read was biochemistry in the job title, and I said, I can do biochemistry.
Yeah.
And so I applied for that job, and strangely enough, even though I got an on-site interview there, that wasn't the job I actually got hired for. It was through my job talk that I was able to establish a connection with someone else who was interviewing me, and he had a vacancy in his group, and so he ended up asking if I would be interested in working for him.
Yeah.
And so he worked in the field we call biologics. And we'll talk a little bit about that later, but it's basically not low molecular weight, not small molecules. And I just thought to myself, okay, well, there's no more chemistry in the name, but I might as well just give it a shot because it sounded like a fun idea.
I mean, so for the stuff that you at least were originally interested in, was it still kind of related to what you did for grad work? I guess how much direct biochemistry did you do in your grad and post-grad work?
Well, it's interesting. So my grad work was actually on shooting proteins with lasers and determining how quickly electrons went from one metal center to another metal center. Mm-hmm. And this is to help people understand how phenomena like photosynthesis works.
Yeah, and whose lab was that in?
So I did my PhD with Harry Gray. Mm-hmm. And so he's a very interesting case because I think that it's because of him that I've been able to see that there are many opportunities once you have a good, solid foundation. So Harry started off in hardcore inorganic chemistry. Mm-hmm. And basically, you know, it was always like, what color is the compound? And then based on that, extracting out what are the structures of these metal complexes that would be responsible for that color.
Mm-hmm.
He took that skill set and he translated it forward towards understanding biochemistry, metalloproteins.
Yeah.
And so I think that what was beautiful about his work is, and he's still active, by the way, he's over 80 years old.
Impressive.
he is so congenial and so easy to work with that he's been able to make inroads with several different disciplines and establish collaborations with many different people to help answer very fundamental questions.
Yeah.
So I think that was a lot of inspiration for how I've been able to navigate my career, which is I have this basis, and maybe biochemistry was where it was hung on.
Mm-hmm.
But I ask myself where I can bring my biochemistry background. So if it's trying to understand a protein-protein interaction.
Yeah.
Or trying to understand how things are folded, or what is the active, how do we target a certain molecule? Those mm-hmm. are the questions that I think that we can still approach from many different perspectives. And I just happen to have the biochemistry background to help with that answer.
Yeah, so you recognized early on that even though you might have been very focused on one particular subset of biochemistry or chemistry, that you could do a lot of things with that.
Mm-hmm.
And hopefully that's something that a lot of people realize when they're doing their grad work. Sure, you might be really narrowly focused, but probably the skills that you've developed will help you do a multitude of different things, both inside and outside the lab, which is always nice. And so I had a question about the group. So you said you applied at Novartis, you gave a talk, and then somebody from another group at Novartis thought you would be good to work with them. So what do you mean by group? So I don't know that, so everybody knows groups in labs in academia, you have them run by different PIs, but how does it work at Novartis?
That's a very good question. So, and that goes to this idea of what it means to be in lab groups. So, overall, I was applying for the cardiovascular and metabolic disease area. So Novartis organizes itself into disease areas and platforms. So platforms are central platforms will assist different disease areas in answering questions.
Okay.
Or sometimes it's a platform such as our chemists, the global discovery chemists. The chemists are responsible for making small molecules for a variety of different programs.
Okay.
For the different disease areas and whatnot. And then we also have another department that's also just straight up discovering any possible pathway that might be associated with diseases too. So there's also that kind of application.
Mm-hmm.
Now, cardiovascular organizes itself into units kind of like analytical biochemistry, biologics, pharmacology, and that can be in vitro and in vivo.
Mm-hmm.
So you got the animals and the cells.
Yeah.
And all this is so that when you put together a project team, so we have several different ways of defining a team or a lab,
sure.
right?
Okay.
And so I think the hierarchical structure that we have right now in these disease areas are basically to say who technically fills out your performance evaluation at the end of the year.
Sure, yeah.
But that person who might give you that feedback might not necessarily be the person telling you every day what assays are going to be important.
Mm-hmm.
And so what we tend to do is when we have a new target that we're thinking about, we involve someone who will help us decide what kind of animal model we need, what kind of cell-based assays we need, how do we characterize the molecules that we're generating? And so a team will often comprise many people from different, not only different people in the disease area, but also people in the different platforms, including a chemist or a therapeutic protein specialist, which is the department I'm in now. So more on that later.
So really, like the different people in different platforms have different types of expertise. So you might be having expertise in like a particular disease area, but then you might also be somebody who's really good at a particular technique. Mm-hmm. And as long as somebody can find you later and say, okay, we originally wanted to do this thing, but we need to know this technique and we need a little bit more information about the area that you guys are experts on, they could come to you and pull you into the project.
Exactly.
Okay, cool.
So the designation is specialist, but jack of all trades.
Sure. Yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm. That's really neat. I mean, I think you don't normally think of it as being as collaborative and like being able to work with so many different people with so many different skill sets. I guess this will kind of get into some of our questioning later, but do you feel like that you've been able to be more collaborative working with a lot of different people at Novartis than you were in, say, academia or in your grad or post-grad work?
It's interesting because this brings... So this reminds me of my experience when I first started at Novartis.
Mm-hmm.
So a lot of, maybe other people have different experiences, but when I exited my postdoc, I felt like it's still very individualistic.
Mm-hmm.
My project, I have to be the one to push science forward.
Yeah.
And if I don't get the science done, then no one else is going to get it done.
Mm-hmm.
And so there was a lot of responsibility and a lot of stress associated with that.
Yeah.
And when I joined Novartis, I didn't quite understand the collaborative mindset.
Yeah.
And so in the very beginning, I started getting something. I was very fortunate, and I worked hard, of course. But I got something to work within the first 6 months of my working.
Mm-hmm.
And then it blew up really quickly. Mm-hmm. And I started getting a lot of people asking me, oh, Crystal, when will the material be ready for this study versus mm-hmm. this study? And at first, I was staying very organized and on top of things. But I was starting to feel a little bit overwhelmed. And I was pulling what I would call like the grad school postdoc hours of staying a little bit later, coming in on the holidays,
yeah.
trying to get stuff done. And I wasn't telling other people that it was too much because it was my first year at work.
Sure.
I didn't want to be one of those complainers or anything like that.
Mm-hmm.
And it actually took a mentor of mine to point out, he said, you know, Crystal, the team needs this to happen. It doesn't have to be done by you.
Mm-hmm.
You could ask for help. And it just blew my mind because I thought, oh, but they want me to be an individual researcher, right? And they said, no, actually, we just care about whether or not we can develop things to a good pace. And
mm-hmm.
so if, and this is hard to stomach too, like mm-hmm. if you're the right determining step, then maybe you should be asking for more resources.
Sure, yeah.
So that things can move faster.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that kind of was like, it just tipped the dominoes, right?
Yeah.
And everything started lining up. I started realizing how, you know, when you're immersed in your research, you don't really notice your surroundings.
Sure.
And I didn't notice that everybody else around me was getting things done in teams and pods.
Yeah.
And so I think that once I realized that, and once I threw myself into that culture
mm-hmm.
and started embracing the fact that I could have other people stressing out with me and helping me make it work, it's been lots of fun.
Yeah.
I think that this is something that it might not be an industry versus academia difference. It could be a difference between a young scientist and a more mature scientist.
Sure, yeah.
Because I think that a lot of academics, a lot of my friends, for instance,
mm-hmm.
when they move from being that postdoc to being the professor, sometimes they start realizing, wait, my grad students are going to be responsible
right.
for my reputation
yeah,
now.
Yeah.
So it becomes a codependent relationship
right.
and cooperative.
So you really learned how to delegate well to other people instead of making yourself be the sole source of power.
Mm-hmm. And that's a very good point, too,
yeah.
because delegating is empowering to the person that you're delegating to as
right.
well, because...
Yeah.
The more responsibilities that are shared around, the more responsible the whole entire group feels, right?
Mm-hmm.
So
yeah, and people get more excited about being on a project that they actually have some buy-in into.
Yes.
And so these are all things that are very, like, I think they're things that people don't think about in grad school, but it's also a big part of kind of advancing your career in general, as you were saying.
Mm-hmm.
Becoming a PI, you really have to think more about management and not just doing everything yourself, because you really can't do it all yourself.
Mm-hmm.
Was that in any way like involved in the decision to move you up as you were at Novartis? So you started off as Investigator 1. When people started realizing that you were able to take on these new skills, was that involved in helping you go higher in the company?
Yes, definitely. I would say that, and getting on board with the group think and trying to work with others means that other people want to work with you more.
Right.
And the more people who want to work with you, the more opportunities that come your way.
Mm-hmm.
And then if you get more opportunities, you get a greater chance to shine. So...
Yeah.
More polish and more recognition
yeah.
leads to career progressions. And so at Novartis, we have, you know, I told you about how we have lab heads.
Right.
You know, that's your direct operational boss.
Mm-hmm.
But then we have this other role called the project team lead, right?
Okay.
And so I got my first project team leader role as an Investigator 1, which... different departments vary, of course, but in the department that I was in, that was a very big accomplishment,
mm-hmm.
and that was very exciting for
me.
Yeah. And through that, I was able to have two and a half excellent years leading this program before I brought it to its natural close.
Yeah.
And it was amazing. And I think that
because I was actually able to kill a project in my department. That's hard in industry. Like, because, you know, just similar to academics, people don't like to be wrong. People don't like to let go.
Yeah, you don't want to kill your darlings,
yes,
right?
Yes, exactly. Yeah, yeah, yeah. But because I was able to demonstrate the maturity of killing my own darling, I think that they were impressed, they being the collective, you know, management or whatnot.
Sure. Yeah.
So I think that a lot of my reputation now is built on being able to work in a team.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that that is something that is very much desired at Novartis.
Mm-hmm.
So.
Cool. And so a little bit more formally about how that process works.
Mm-hmm.
For me, one of the most scary things in the world is asking for a raise or doing something like that.
Mm-hmm.
When you're moving up into these different positions, did you have to confront, say, your supervisor directly and say, I would like to have this increased title or this raise or whatever, or what did it come kind of naturally?
I think this is a very important question,
yeah.
And I want everybody to think about this, because when I started, my very first day, I sat down with my boss, who I had known for less than 8 hours,
mm-hmm.
and he said, oh, how are you doing? I said, you know, I'm doing great, I'm figuring things out. And we did our natural dot the I's, cross the T's. But then at the very end, I shifted into development mode.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that having a development conversation is actually very important, because most managers don't think about what their direct reports are thinking, right?
Sure,
and
yeah.
Each person has their own different path.
Mm-hmm.
So on my first day, I asked my boss, I said, hey, you know, I see myself maybe 2 years from now being eligible for promotion.
Mm-hmm.
How do I achieve that? What do I need to do to get there?
Mm-hmm.
And so I think what was important in that conversation is emphasizing that I didn't feel like I was ready for it, and
right.
I wasn't entitled to it. Of course not.
Yeah.
But the thing is, lining it up 2 years in advance gives him plenty of time to figure out the strategy.
Yeah, definitely.
And then it also gives me a lot of time to start accruing the reputation.
Right.
But I would say it's a lot easier to have this conversation 2 years in advance,
mm-hmm.
than it is to come in one day and ask for a raise,
sure.
or whatnot. Because yeah. then they'll say, well, you know, you were fine yesterday.
Mm-hmm.
So I think it also demonstrates a certain amount of maturity in terms of knowing what you want.
Mm-hmm.
Because I think that there's a culture out there that says, okay, if I go in and if I work really hard, they're going to notice that I worked really hard,
right.
and they're going to give me recognition for it.
Yeah.
And that's true too.
Mm-hmm.
But the thing is, I always ask myself whether or not the person I'm recognizing, am I recognizing them in a way that's going to help them get to where they want to go?
Right.
And if I'm giving them the right opportunities.
Mm-hmm.
Because if someone wants to become a project team lead, then they're going to need more exposure to opportunities where they have to start making bigger decisions, think strategically about
right.
the project.
Yeah.
But if they're more interested in developing their what we call assay toolkit, like, oh, I haven't learned how to do cell-based assays yet,
mm-hmm.
then at that point, I just look at a project that might have that opportunity and I point them in that direction.
Yeah. Yeah.
So it's very much a difference between just knowing where people want to go and where they see themselves.
Yeah. So like the manager's job is to enable you in the end, but if you don't tell them in the first place what you want to be enabled to do, then you're never going to get where you want to go, right?
It's always going to be a guessing game,
yeah.
right?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So as a manager now, do you kind of like tell your reports that directly, or do you kind of wait for them to see if they have that initiative like you had?
I recognize that my initiative was a little bit different from a lot of other people's.
Yeah.
So in the conversations that I've had one direct report who was very much gung-ho, always told me what she was thinking.
Yeah.
And I always knew whether or not she was happy, and I knew what her end goal was.
Mm-hmm.
So I helped her get there. Her goal, when she entered Novartis, she wanted to go to med school.
Mm-hmm.
So she said, you've got me for 3 years. I will do my best for you.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, that's fine. And so we worked very well together. I gave her opportunities to develop her lab skills, give her opportunities to develop her communication skills, because she, whenever she needed it, she would ask for it.
Yeah.
And then ultimately, you know, the relationship that we had, she told me a whole year in advance before she left, because I had to write her a letter of recommendation.
Yeah.
But that makes it a much easier relationship, because she was working very hard all the way to the end. She didn't have senioritis or anything like that.
Yeah.
My second direct report that I have right now, she's a little bit less upfront about what she needs.
Mm-hmm.
So what I've been doing is I've been trying to make myself available to her.
Sure.
And we check in once a week just to see how she's doing.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, with scientists, a lot of it will start with just a discussion about science and assays and analyzing results.
Yeah.
And then that will also eventually develop into, okay, well, now that you've got these results, how would you interpret them?
Mm-hmm.
And then eventually we got to a point where now she will tell me when she needs something.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that I'm learning very slowly that different people require different things.
Right, yeah.
And I'm trying to be patient.
Yeah, and that's something that's hard to know as a scientist, too, right? Because it's another one of those things where, as a scientist, you go in and say, okay, I have a set protocol I have to follow to do this thing. I should be able to give that protocol to anybody and they'll know how to do it. But when you're doing management work, right, you realize that that's not the case at all. Like, you need to be able to explain things to people in different ways. You need to be able to get people to talk about things in different ways. You need to figure out what people's problems are in different ways. And it's definitely an interesting skill set that you really have to, like, push yourself to develop, right? So I guess kind of how did you push yourself to develop that skill set? And what do you do now in order to develop that skill set?
Well, the good news is that companies will occasionally have management trainings.
Mm-hmm.
Novartis has a management training course, and so I was sent away to that at one point, and that was very eye-opening. I have to say that one of the things that's very fascinating about PhDs is that they don't come with management training manuals or anything like that.
Yeah.
And we all know sometimes, we always know that weird person in lab who's a little bit strange, you know, and you always wonder, how are they going to be a boss? And,
right.
And so eventually we all have to become managers, though, because the way that we're educated, PhDs end up leading labs in industry or in academia.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that when I was a grad student, I did not recognize that well. I recognized what was a good boss and what was a bad boss.
Yeah.
And you know what not to do,
mm-hmm.
but then you don't know that people learn different ways, like you were mentioning.
Right.
And people have different learning styles. I think that for me, a lot of my management training actually came on the fly, because before I got my first direct report, I actually indirectly managed a couple of people.
Mm-hmm.
And I was very fortunate to have people who gave me feedback on how I was doing in certain situations.
Sure,
And it's not like they were like saying, oh, Crystal, that was terrible or something like that, but they were just saying, oh, Crystal, you know, next time you need something from me, you can ask it this way, or you can just send me an email. You don't have to do it this way.
Mm-hmm.
And so being receptive and open to hearing these nudges along the way, I think has definitely helped.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the other thing that helps for a lot of new managers to be is actually just working alongside associates. So
mm-hmm.
I was very fortunate to start as an investigator one. There are some people will start an investigator two, and they might be more removed from the lab bench.
Yeah.
But by being in the lab bench and having my closest friends be at the bench too, I saw their frustrations and their delights with their managers.
Sure,
and so I would know when this person did a great job managing this person. And I would be able to accrue, you know, it's data-driven people, right?
Yeah,
so
right.
It's like, good data. I know how to do this. Yeah, and you learn by mimicking and just by examples.
Yeah. I mean, some of the things that we do here, so when people are going into management positions, we set up like peer review system, or not peer review, we end up setting up peer mentoring groups.
Mm-hmm.
And so the mentoring group, it does exactly what you said. You talk to each other about like what worked, what didn't work,
mm-hmm.
how you can change things going forward. I would love to see more of that happening in academia among PIs, because hopefully that would help things a little bit. Mm-hmm. Because as you're saying, PIs, even though we don't often think of it this way, they're first and foremost managers mm-hmm. of a bunch of people in their labs. And I think if you can do well as a manager, you can always attract more people to your lab just because everybody has a much better experience when you're really focusing on those management skills. Mm-hmm. And as you're saying, it really does take effort to develop management skills. You think of it as like, I hate the word soft skills, right? Mm-hmm. Because it really, it's not...
They're very hard.
Yeah, they're very hard to develop. I mean, there are some people who are incredibly good, like natural people,
yeah.
right? Who can just manage straight away, get people to do things for them exactly mm-hmm. how they want them very quickly, but not everybody can do that. And you really need to like think about new ways to do that. And as you're saying, there's tons of data out there on what works, what doesn't work, mm-hmm. and different techniques you can use. So that's all really awesome. I'm glad to hear that you're doing all this like management training stuff, because it's nice to see other people acknowledging the importance of it, because I don't think you see it as much in the sciences as I would like for it to be. But you also have a lot of stuff going on in the science side of things. You had said that you ended up basically transferring over from one project that you originally started on. Can you give me a little details on like what that project was and how it came to a close?
It's interesting that you say that. So I've been at Novartis for about maybe 5.5 years now. And in this time, I started on one platform, which was an RNA therapeutic. And then...
What does that mean exactly?
So it's a nucleic acid-based therapeutic, mm-hmm. and that's about all I'm
going
to
say. Okay.
But from there, we had a small mini platform within cardiovascular at the time. And once we were working on that for 2.5 years, there were some internal decisions on what we should and shouldn't be working on. And so this is the difference between academia and industry. Mm-hmm. When someone tells you to stop, you kind of have to stop.
Right.
And so from there, I was given the project that I got to lead for a little bit of time, another 2.5 years, mm-hmm. right? And that one was on a therapeutic antibody project. So basically, you've got things like Humira out there on the market. That's an antibody. Mm-hmm. I mean, to show you how naive I was, when I first started in pharma, I mean, I didn't know the classes other than low molecular weight.
Sure,
because
yeah.
I was a chemist, and mm-hmm. I wasn't paying attention. I wasn't savvy on those kind of things.
Mm-hmm.
And so...
Did that come up during your interview process at all?
Oh, definitely.
Yeah.
and like, interview processes may vary, but I think that... sometimes I wonder how I got my job. I'm very happy that they took the chance on me, and I consistently now still feel that I'm still catching up on trying to stay ahead of all the blogs and all the fierce biotech articles and
sure.
all those other things going on out there. But I think that maybe the other aspect where I have been able to do things efficiently or effectively is because of the fact that I don't come in with any baggage.
Mm-hmm.
I kind of just go like, let's not worry about that. Let's just give it a try.
Right, yeah.
And so some of my gambles have paid off. Some of them, if they don't work, I kill them quickly. Mm-hmm. And because of that, that's how I do my science. Mm-hmm. I ask myself, and I think this is the way that we like to structure things at Novartis, ask yourself some key scientific questions, and you should always gate them on things like, if I get this, then we'll keep on going.
Mm-hmm.
If I don't get this, then really we should be thinking about stopping it.
Right.
And if you set that expectation at the start before you get too involved,
mm-hmm.
then you have a reminder, like you have a document that you can refer to and say, yeah, I did say I would do that.
So do you think that that works well with more basic sciences? I could see how that can work really well in an applied setting. But if you're just trying to figure out how RNA polymerase works,
mm-hmm.
For example, do you see that being applied there too?
Yes, to a certain extent. I mean, you ask yourself, what experiments can I run to understand this? And what steps do I need to understand the most, right?
Mm-hmm.
We're talking initiation, elongation,
sure.
what reagents.
Yeah.
and what spectroscopies are available to me,
mm-hmm.
and then and what ways to study, right? Mm-hmm. And then if you, and then you come up with a list that says like, okay, I will run this experiment. And of course, there's no such thing as a yes or no question. You know,
right.
In science, you kind of get kind of most of the time, right?
Right.
But the thing is, you have if you can say, you know, this has to be something you have to revisit. It's a document that can evolve.
Mm-hmm.
But if you set some thresholds in the very beginning, say, mm-hmm. I need to demonstrate at least this with this technique.
Yeah.
Then, yes, we can move forward.
Yeah.
If I cannot do it in 6 months, then maybe I should revisit whether or not I should be doing it, or are there other ways out there?
Yeah.
I think the...
Sunk costs are sunk, right?
Yeah. I mean, I say this having experienced a postdoc where I ended up spending 3 years of my life trying to prove a model wrong, mm-hmm. right? And so... I learned many different techniques, which was awesome,
mm-hmm.
but I could never, the goalpost kept on moving.
Sure.
Right? So I think if, as a man, and this is a manager thing too. I mean, if your manager helps you define where you're supposed to be letting things go and where you can keep on going,
mm-hmm.
And not just managers, but mentors, senior lab heads, department heads. This is a burden that goes on the, I mean, it's a burden that the whole company should think about, because if you spend too much time and money on something,
yeah.
that's time and money that could be spent on another project that
right.
could have been more useful.
Yeah, definitely. And I also think that that way of thinking, it should be permeating people's actual experiments too, because you always have the problem, right, where somebody says, okay, I got this result. What p-value do I need, or what p-value did I end up with, and can I say that that's significant? Whereas if you're thinking about it the way that you're saying,
mm-hmm.
what you would do is say, I need a p-value of less than 0.01,
yeah.
right?
Mm-hmm.
And if anything doesn't cross that threshold, that's your initial assessment of whether or not you should even keep going with that experiment.
Mm-hmm.
And that ends up getting you more reproducible results, right? Because you're not trying to do, like you said before, moving the goalpost because this is the thing that I've been banging my head against.
Mm-hmm.
You're really trying to be swift and move on to a new project that might actually be much more successful
mm-hmm.
in the end. And you aren't kind of like trying to not fudge the data, but trying to work with what you have to tell a story. You'll
mm-hmm.
have a much more impactful story if you really know what kind of metrics you want to fulfill in the beginning.
Yes.
You apply that every day, I'm assuming, and so that's kind of how the RNA project ended up falling through, is that something didn't end up meeting those metrics?
Yeah. I can't talk to you
okay.
about that.
Okay.
But I will say that for the other program, on the therapeutic antibody program,
yeah.
I'll admit there was a three-month interlude. There was a three-month interlude that I should have already killed the project,
mm-hmm.
but scientifically, it was just one last question that I was just like, let's just dot the I, cross that T, and
yeah.
get it done.
Yeah.
And then I would have said that I did everything possible to try to make this work.
Sure.
And it was a very depressing last 3 months
mm-hmm.
on that program. It's very hard to stay positive when you know, like, you're kind of hoping that the data doesn't come back and say, maybe. Because if
yeah.
there's a maybe in there, then you go, oh, maybe I should be, no.
But do you feel you get less maybe answers when you have the metrics set out for you in the first place?
Yes,
yeah.
yes. And the other thing is, it's always a big picture question, right?
Mm-hmm.
Because you might come in to work every day to work on your one experiment because you love it and it's your darling and
mm-hmm.
it's your project and you want to keep it going. But at the end of the day, it's still something you're developing for the company.
Mm-hmm.
It's still something that you're developing for your team.
Mm-hmm.
And I like to think of it as, are the team's resources best used this way?
Right. However that ended up working, you ended up moving on to a few new projects. So you had the antibody project.
Mm-hmm.
So what are you working on now? I guess you can't go into detail, I'm
yeah.
sure. But
So it's interesting. Last year at around maybe September or October,
mm-hmm.
I think it was October, Jay Bradner, who is our new president of Novartis Institutes of Biomedical Research, he basically finally unraveled unveiled his new organization strategy. Mm-hmm. So he started in March, so he had a whole half year where he was basically looking around, checking out what Novartis looked like and what he liked and what he didn't like. Mm-hmm. And so in his fall town hall, he actually said, okay, this is the Novartis that I envision now. Mm-hmm. And so he started a new department called Chemical Biology and Therapeutics, CBT.
Okay.
And at the same time, he also started doing some reorganization. And since my group in cardiovascular specialized in biologics, mm-hmm. They moved us into the biologics unit.
Okay.
And it was already an existing unit.
Yeah.
So because of that, that meant that I stayed working on the protein class, but then I ended up expanding my target space, because before I was only working on cardiovascular targets, and now I get to work on neuroscience targets
cool.
too. So
yeah.
it's nice.
So you're kind of expanding, you're applying your expertise to a lot more things now that you're in this more broad group than mm-hmm. you were before. That's
yeah.
neat. All right, so you've given us a lot of advice on the management side of things, but going back to when you were first getting into Novartis, first going into industry, I'm sure it was a little bit confusing for you. It's a little bit confusing for me because I've never worked in industry.
Mm-hmm.
So I guess what kind of advice can you give to young scientists who are planning on working in industry or even that aren't planning on it? Maybe some reasons why they should think about it.
Well, I think that, you know, when we're ready to apply for jobs, we always feel like, okay, I know who I am, I know where I want to go, and what I want to do. Toss that out the window and stay open-minded. I think it's, you never know how careers develop. And this is something I've noticed about academia as well as industry.
Mm-hmm.
A person will propose to do a certain kind of research to open their labs in academics.
Yeah.
And they'll still end up changing science always dictates everything, right?
Right.
Trends will dictate who gets funding, what kind of research is funded. Same thing goes with industry. Maybe you think that you're going to be a biochemist, but then maybe the only job that's available or on offer is the biologics one. And I struggled with that decision for a little bit because I thought to myself, oh, I have to start all over again. And I don't know anything about this class of drugs.
Sure.
I don't have the background But then I just said, you know, I got the job. So clearly they think I can do it. And I should just bring it and
yeah.
see what happens. And so, and again, this goes back to this idea that everyone on your team
mm-hmm.
knows something different.
Right.
Don't try to be like the guy who sits next to you. If you did that, then both of your time is wasted. Only one of you has to be there.
Mm-hmm.
So make sure that when you're actually on the team or contributing to a program, that you are yourself. You bring your full self to this table, because I'm pretty sure that we all have different backgrounds.
Mm-hmm.
And so our skill sets are different, and our expertise and our expert opinions are different.
Right.
And just because one person is more experienced in the field than
mm-hmm.
you,
mm-hmm.
and it's a new field, doesn't mean that you know nothing. It means that you know something different.
Yeah. So I guess a lot of what that gets into is kind of being able to be fleet-footed, being able to kind of change what you're able to work on to be able to develop new skills so you can fill the niche that's required for you. I guess what are some ways that you can demonstrate that you're able to do that, that you're able to transition to different needs as they arise?
That's a very good question. I would say that take a look at your own history and demonstrate, maybe think about a few instances where you've actually had to interface with another discipline or taken on a different opportunity that is slightly outside of your comfort zone or your field of expertise.
Mm-hmm.
For me, it was a little bit easier because of the fact that I started my training as an organic chemist, and then I ended up in bioinorganic chemistry, shooting things with lasers, which involved biophysics.
Yeah.
And then I eventually shifted to biochemistry, where I was, you know, still studying metalloproteins,
mm-hmm.
but also studying iron sulfur clusters, which are completely crazy self-assembled things.
Sure, yeah.
Each time you start over, I think that it's intimidating.
Mm-hmm.
But the more times you start over, the better off you're going to be because of the fact that you can demonstrate that agility.
Right.
And I think agility is actually a trait that is very much prized in industry because, as we mentioned before, your project can be dropped tomorrow.
Right.
Or you might be given an opportunity in something that you haven't heard of before, and you have to Google it to find out what that is,
right.
You know?
Yeah.
And you have to be prepared for it because you want to say whether or not you want that opportunity. Does it make sense for you to take it?
Mm-hmm.
And then at the end of the day, to successfully lead it, you have to own it.
Right.
You can't just say, oh, I'm going to try, you know.
You have to go, as you said, you really have to bring it to whatever you're working on. And that's, I mean, that's interesting too, because one of the things that you can do in order to get through grad school kind of quickly is to be really knowledgeable about one particular assay that gets you results all the time, and mm-hmm. to do that assay over and over again. And maybe at some point you'll like hit the wall with that, but you can really generate a lot of data if you know a lot about one particular thing. But what you're saying here is really you have to be thinking about moving on to new projects. Hopefully that's something that people can take to heart too. I mean, when I was a grad student, I was starting new projects all the time. Always because part of me got kind of bored. Maybe that's part of why I didn't want to go into academia in the end, because I didn't think I would want to focus on one thing all the time. But I think that's a as you're saying now, really a way to be successful in any career, even in academia, is to be able to see what the openings are and really jump on them. So if something's failing, again, you could jump onto something new.
Mm-hmm.
So that's definitely something that grad students could practice, even if at the outset they might think, no, I have to do this one thing for my thesis. Mm-hmm. But no, you can kind of diversify and do a lot of different stuff. For
yes.
Sure.
Yeah. And in industry, you can, I mean, especially for people, okay, so there are people who are considered like specialists, right?
Mm-hmm.
But the thing is, you can get boxed in real quick. And then the way that we are deadline oriented sometimes in projects, if you're really well known for running that one assay,
yeah.
The good news is you're always going to be on every single one of those reports that pushes the drug to clinic. So
yeah.
That if you want that, then that's great.
Mm-hmm.
And you'll probably always get recognition as being that expert.
Yeah.
The other person is that person who does a little bit of this and jumps from thing to thing. And for the learning curve junkies like us, I think that being caught in that specialist role would be very difficult.
Mm-hmm.
I like having the ability to jump around,
mm-hmm.
and I like having the freedom. I might change my mind for all I know. I'm still very young in my industry career.
Sure, yeah.
But just looking at the role models I have at Novartis, I've seen that they've had to change their roles many times
right.
in the course of their careers.
Well, an assay can become obsolete right?
yes.
at any point.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, so even if you think that like you're the expert in this and you'll mm-hmm. always be needed, you might not be
mm-hmm.
Because something just usurps you in the future. So this gets to a question that I think I've heard from a lot of friends when they start applying for jobs, is that companies will often say, we really need somebody who knows how to do, I don't know why you would want this, but Southern blots, right? And they need to be the greatest expert in Southern blots ever. Would you say that is actually what the company is really looking for all the time, or should people apply even if they're not like the person who's done this every day of their lives?
I would say that, and this goes back to our original conversation about what advice that I would have to give. And that is, if you look at the responsibilities and 50% of them
mm-hmm.
are what you can cover, just apply for it.
Yeah.
And I can't guarantee you that you're going to get the opportunity to interview, but I will say that applying for something is much more successful than not applying at all. Right.
Right? Exactly.
And I would say the reason why I'm saying this is because of the fact that most of the hires that we've made into my department, at least, are not for specialists. We're not looking for someone who can only run ELISAs. We
right.
are looking for someone who can jump from one task to another without any trouble.
Right.
And broaden their skill set, of course. And we look for potential.
Yeah.
I can't guarantee that always all the needs are that way. Sometimes they have this really fancy mass spectrometer.
Right.
And then someone left. And then so now they have to find that person that can run that
yeah.
instrument, right?
Yeah.
So it depends on the need. But you don't know the context. You're not going to know
right.
that context until you show up that
yeah.
day, right?
Yeah. And then the other thing is you really have to kind of get practice at doing interviews.
Oh, yes.
Right? Because
mm-hmm.
it is, you very rarely go into that kind of mindset where you have to go in and show yourself within a couple of hours exactly as your best self can possibly be, mm-hmm. without getting too tired, without appearing that you're not going to be excited about the job. And so even if you don't think you're 100% qualified for one thing, get the practice for it anyway, mm-hmm. right? It'll help you out in later interviews as well.
It's true. And I mean, even in the, I had the day-long interview for the biochemistry position that I didn't get hired for, and I felt like I tanked the first three interviews of that day. Mm-hmm. And one of them was with like the global head of cardiovascular research. Uh-huh. So I didn't know how the rest of the day was going to go. You know, I had a lunch break and then we had to get another three interviews. But I realized it felt like a video game. Like you just like you die and then you like get resurrected. And you're like, I know how to jump over that pit.
Yeah.
And the way that interviews go, depending on how the company interviews, you're going to start getting the same questions or they're going to try to dig deeper into something that they heard.
Right.
So if you get the same questions, practice your answers.
Right.
Yeah. change them up. So it's, or if you know that the best version of yourself can show up at the last hour of the day, then bring it there too. Because I remember one time we were interviewing someone else and I was talking to a department head and he mentioned, oh, it doesn't matter how they did at the beginning of the day. It just matters how they do at the end,
mm-hmm.
because we're also seeing how they learn
right?
Yeah. So.
Yeah, I mean, that's the thing, too, is remember, any part of your interview isn't in a vacuum. Those people are going back and talking to each other about everything that you said in every interview.
Yes.
So if you really shine through for one person, they might become your best advocate at that particular job.
Mm-hmm.
So now that we're kind of on the topic of going into an interview or applying for jobs, a question that I often hear from people is whether or not you need to have a PhD or you need to have a postdoc to go into industry. So what kind of levels of scientists do you guys hire at Novartis?
So Novartis is different from, I'll say how Novartis is different from the other industries or other big companies. Novartis has this investigator track, which mm-hmm. is basically indicative of a PhD. If you see senior scientist or scientist, you won't see senior scientist for Novartis. You'll see scientist, scientific associate.
Mm-hmm.
Those are for non-PhDs. Usually, if we're listing for an investigator, it means we're looking for an investigator.
Mm-hmm.
If we're looking for a scientist, we're looking for a scientist.
Mm-hmm.
So oftentimes, if you're applying with a PhD for a scientist position,
you're not going to be
called in. The investigator track now, it's interesting because you have your investigator 1, 2, and 3, and then you have your senior investigator 1 and 2.
Mm-hmm.
And investigator 1s and 2s can be known as project lead, you know, team lead, lab head, those kind of terms. So I applied for lab head,
mm-hmm.
and during my interview, they asked me, so have you had experience leading people? And I said, no. and the guy said, well, then do you have experience with cardiovascular? And I said, no. So, you know, that didn't go so well. But again, you know, that was the middle of the day. By the end of the day, I was doing great.
Sure.
But I think that, again, they listed for a certain skill set. I didn't necessarily have it,
mm-hmm.
but I was still ish, right? They could round me into something that I could fit into a position there.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes when you want to read between the lines on a Novartis job listing,
mm-hmm.
they see levels of experience, right?
Mm-hmm.
Some of them will just say PhD, postdoc preferred,
mm-hmm.
postdoc required, or, you know, 5 years of industry required. 5 years of industry required minimum usually implies that they want someone more more senior. So this would be a senior investigator, which is a boss of bosses, right?
Right.
So I'm an investigator 3, and I currently report to a director, but there's also another configuration where I would report to a senior investigator.
Okay.
So the next step up for me is senior investigator 1, which
yeah.
means that one day I'm going to have to learn how to be a good manager of a manager.
Sure, yeah. Mm-hmm. And so can the scientist level, the people who don't have the PhDs, Can they move up through Novartis and show themselves as capable of being an investigator?
Yes, there are semi-permeable membranes at certain levels. So scientist 2 and investigator 1 is the first time that you can see that.
Mm-hmm.
And then you can also do this between, the next step for a scientist 2 is a scientific technical leader.
Yeah.
And they can go into investigator 2.
Okay.
So I would say that that's where your reputation will be fixed. Once you get beyond, you don't really see any transfer between the two tracks.
Sure.
But the person I'm thinking of, she has like 11 years of industry experience. To get into the investigator track from a scientist position requires a lot of advocating for yourself.
Sure.
Because of the fact that this is, if you thought it was already hard enough to ask for a promotion, this is asking for a change in track.
Right.
And this is, for a lot of managers, difficult to process.
Mm-hmm.
And again, the sooner your boss knows you want this, the easier it's going to be for you to figure out your plan forward.
Yeah.
A lot of people will say, oh, but I'd rather just prove myself first. But the thing is, again, your boss might be thinking she's going to make a great scientific technical leader one day.
Yeah.
When you're thinking, oh, I thought I was demonstrating myself as an investigator. So I think that the more people who know your intention, the more opportunities are. And this is not just your boss. This is going to be your peers. This could be your boss's peer.
Yeah.
That could be thinking about things that might have, he might have influence with your boss.
Right.
And so you want to keep a dialogue open.
Mm-hmm.
That's probably the best way to go about this.
Yeah.
Some people can just go up through the ranks and they just get the opportunities. They ask for the opportunities. They say, hey, no one's leading that project. I think I could do this.
Yeah.
Or sometimes you get tapped to do it.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes it's a great project to lead. And sometimes it's just something you have to carry for a while so that you demonstrate that you care.
Sure.
And that you can do it.
So in the end, it is possible to move around, even mm-hmm. without a PhD, but you really have to be focused on what you want in order to make it happen.
Yes, Novartis is very, I would say the phenotype of a successful person at Novartis is proactive.
Mm-hmm.
If you ask for it, then people are always willing to listen
mm-hmm.
and help you figure things out. I mean, they won't hand you the opportunities right away,
yeah.
but they'll definitely coach you to finding the right opportunities.
Cool. Excellent. Okay, so talking about opportunities, we met at a speaking opportunity some time ago. It was a science communications panel. I guess to start off this, I just wanted to go back to something that you said a little bit earlier, which was that PhDs often end up as heads of labs. I'd like to modify that a little bit and just say that we often end up being managers,
mm-hmm.
probably in large part because we have project management skills. So when you're working towards your PhD, you have a graduate project that you're working on. If you're a postdoc, you're doing even a little bit more independent work on a research project. But we don't really develop necessarily the people management skills that are required in more of a business setting. And part of that is also having communication skills. How have you developed your communication skills at Novartis or even throughout your time as a PhD and a postdoc? And how have they helped you within your current role?
Well, I'll admit that I was late coming into the communication training.
Mm-hmm.
It's one of those things that came up when I first started at Novartis. The project that I was working on was taking off, and we started getting people from all these other departments showing up at the meetings, and they were asking all these questions about, they make sense now, of course, but back then it was just like, more problems. But it was always a developability idea, like, how do we make this thing that you're doing in the lab into a drug? and so I was just like, those are more questions that I don't want to deal with, right? And at that time, I was still very data-driven. I was still very much focused on delivering on cool scientific ideas.
Mm-hmm.
And it came to a head when someone, I think it was my manager, he was just telling me, you have to sit down with this guy. You have to figure this out because we won't get buy-in from this department to move forward unless you get his agreement.
Mm-hmm.
And at that time, I remember feeling very much like, wait, nobody told me I had to get along with people or try to figure out how to talk to this person, because part of it is that I knew in my head that we were speaking two different languages. Mm-hmm. I was trying to speak like scientist babble.
Yeah.
And that person was trying to tell me, you know, industry babble.
Right.
And we were not meeting. And I think at that time, I did not know how to ask the right questions. So what I ended up doing was I signed up for one of the Novartis mentorship programs. And I was lined up with, when you're applying for a mentor, they say, what do you need help with? And I said, communication.
Uh-huh.
And so they put me with a director of communications. And she has been phenomenal. And she's still, I mean, this happened 5 years ago. She's still my mentor.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
I what I love about this relationship is that she is a continual reminder.
Mm-hmm.
Because, you know, she was helpful to me in navigating that relationship that first brought this on, right?
Yeah.
But since then, I thought that the problem was over. So I was like, okay, thanks, mentor. I don't need you anymore. But we liked each other, so we still kept in touch. And so we were having lunch every month. And then she'd ask me, oh, how are things going? And it always became an issue of, oh, how come this person won't do this for me? Or how come I can't get this done? This mind function is really holding me up. How do I get them to agree with me? And she said, well, have you asked them what they need?
Mm-hmm.
And so it just took someone listening to me and just saying, why didn't you just do it that?
Yeah.
And I think that because of that continual exposure to someone who was bigger-minded.
Yeah.
I think that I was able to get to be a better communicator.
Sure, yeah.
And I think the other thing that helps is that once you become a project team leader, you're going to be working with people with different expertise. And you also start learning that not everybody at the table is a scientist. Some of them are lawyers. Some of them are doctors.
Yeah.
And at the end of the day, they still need to know what's going on in your project. And they need to be able to, they all internalize your results differently.
Mm-hmm.
They're seeing a new deadline. They're seeing a different study that they have to modify. And so you want to be aware of how they're feeling in the room too, because every deviation you have from normal path, which is almost always,
mm-hmm.
requires a little bit of negotiation.
Right.
And adjustment to the plan.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So I guess a takeaway kind of for the communication side is always kind of practice being aware of what other people need and what kind of where they're coming from.
Yes.
Which again is a little bit different from how you think about getting like, all right, I'm doing this project, I'm getting this data, like I'm no matter what, I'm just going to make this happen. Things mm-hmm. don't happen unless you're really communicating what's happening to other people.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, that's awesome. I mean, one of the things that we focus on a lot here is, like, mentorship and key to being able to get, like, advanced in your career is finding those mentors who are mm-hmm. going to help you out. So definitely good to hear that from another side, too.
Mm-hmm.
So that's all the questions that I have for you. Thanks for sitting down and talking to me
mm-hmm.
And to talking to the listeners of the AdGene podcast.
Mm-hmm.
You have any last things that you want to say to people?
Have fun. I think that there are a lot of opportunities out there, and some of them might sound difficult, but that makes it that much more fun, right?
Yeah.
So don't think that just because you spent the last 7 years studying one protein that you're limited to only doing that one protein or that one assay. I think that the sooner you realize how much fun you can have with other things, the more successful you're going to be in your career.
As Eddie and I are forging our own career paths, we agree with Crystal. It's important to think about what you really want, ask for it, and to have fun throughout the journey to achieve it. Only then can you really be your most successful self. After all, that's how we started this podcast in the first place. For more perspectives on various science career paths, listen to our other podcast episodes and check out our career posts on the AdGene blog. AdGene, a better way to share science.